Ladies and gentlemen, Season 2, Episode 3, Zebra Stripes Podcast. I am Coach Gene Clemens, joined as always by my good friend Whit Legere. Coach Whit, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Always coming in with a nice, easy, doing very well, thank you. If only these people knew, if only they knew the fire that I know, if only they knew that guy. Put him on a basketball court and see if he's still that same old. Yeah, you know, it's nice to see you. It's great. You know, it's great. Yeah, put some fire under there. I bet it's a different Coach Whit. Are you starting to get that urge as you get closer to game one? Are you?
Yes. Yeah. Juices are flowing. Sometimes I call it basketball is bouncing in my brain. You know, some sleep interruption with diagrams and such things, but all good. Good preseason, energized. So, yep.
You know, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, and I've actually meant to ask you about this for, gosh, years now, because of the nature of your job at a one and done school. Do you ever just come into the season and go, we're going to do something completely different than we did in the past? Or do you always just let that kind of be dictated by the personnel that you get? Or better question, do you sometimes say, hey, I'm going to go about picking the groceries different this year than I did last year because I want to see something?
Well, yeah, I don't have the luxury because of sort of the Division III model, if you will, and not giving out full scholarships. So you don't have the luxury of picking exactly the way that you might want. So it's all finding fit where you want that fit, and the family wants the fit, and the financial fit has to work. So there's some of that. Okay. You don't get to choose it perfectly, but, you know, timely question for you, for sure. Always on it. You're very, very timely. That's one thing about you. I would have I wonder if you have spies up here. I don't know. Good thing this podcast isn't too public yet. But I would say this. My old Al Lewis, who you know, longtime assistant, when we would have conversations, he would say, Whit, it seems to me, you like to do the same thing just a little bit differently each year. So that suggested to me, you know, hey, at core, we wanted to essentially play the same way, but maybe the way we went about it year to year, maybe was a little bit different, either the teaching progression or even the, you know, whatever wrinkles that we might be, you know, whatever spices we were throwing into the stew. So that's one thing. And so I think sometimes other people that are know you, right, people outside yourself, sometimes offer you glimpses into yourself that you're not even aware of. So I always appreciated Al's insight on that. I thought he was right. But then as you get older, you're actually more willing, I think, to take a few risks than less. So that's freed me up some too. And, you know, without disclosing what the Wolverines are aiming to unleash, I would just say, like, this is a year where we're doing some things dramatically different. Well, dramatic is strong, but we're doing it different. And it's in part myself and Paris, my assistant coach, Paris Horn. But in part, it's the personnel too. And just kind of seeing them in preseason workouts early on and going, oh, okay, And that's another thing Al used to tell me too, when I get frustrated about putting together our offense. He goes, well, I mean, obviously you've got to wait and see a little bit what you got and how things kind of fit together before you move it along too far. So, very, very timely question by Gene. And so, and I am fortunate, right, that if it doesn't go so well, I'm not, you know, I'm not getting fired because I lost a couple games the alums aren't going to like, you know, or anything like that. So,
yeah, does that, and that's the thing. I think from that too, would you say that there are certain things that regardless of the year, this has to be?
Yeah. I mean, yes. So, I mean, that's where you get into the, I don't know how far I want to go into the weeds here, but like philosophically, we're looking for unselfish team guys. I'm looking for guys that love the game. I'm looking for guys that have a certain toughness about them, whether that's physical, mental, or both, right? And there are reasons for sort of all of that. And then we try to translate that into aggressive basketball, if you will. Pace, you know, is a pretty word in vogue these days. But so we're going to try to play aggressively, which for me typically means a man-to-man style of defense. You know, not to say we wouldn't do something else, because we have and we might, but based around core concepts of man-to-man defense, and we're going to be a movement. We're going to try to be a movement type of team. So we're going to share the sugar, you know, we're going to move the ball in ourselves, keep energy in the ball, this and that. So regardless of how we kind of do those things or what our man-to-man defense looks like or kind of how that offense really plays out, hopefully you're going to see movement and unselfishness, right? And you're going to see aggressiveness and hunger on the defensive end. And I don't know. So, yeah, I think there's core things. You know, we're going to take care of the ball, blah, blah, blah. And then we talk more about those things, concepts, right? Teaching more principles and concepts more than, you know, just X and O's necessarily. And I think a lot, and you know what, every time I read about Coach K or read the Redeem Team, or excuse me, because we're going to talk about that tonight, I know, watching the Netflix Redeem Team, you know, again, ever since Coach K, that was right when I was coming up, when he was starting out. So, you know, again, relationships rather than necessarily all just, you know, chalkboard stuff, right? Most coaches, as I've studied him, they don't, you know, Coach K wasn't necessarily built on the best X's and O's around. They weren't the worst either, but he got people to play together. He got teams to play together. He got guys to play hard. So, I mean, I think that's in this environment for a lot of reasons. I think the relationships are central to what we're doing. That was actually my question by Brad Smith, the AD at the time that you knew when you were here, when he said, okay, Whit, seeing in your resume, you're a good motivator. What makes you a good motivator? And she's like, wow, like I never told anyone I was trying to be Vince Lombardi or nothing, but you know, it's however you do it, right? Getting the buy-in from the guys, and there you go. So
yeah, no, I think you bring up a good point though. Like everybody has to have the thing that they hang their hat on, right? You know, yep. I feel like regardless of sport, and I don't think we ever have to worry about getting in too far into the weeds with, because I think we're a coach's pod. Ah. We're a pod for guys like us.
Okay, you know, good.
We want to talk a little something, but we want to also do a little shop talk. I think some of our best feedback has been when we've talked shop.
That's true. Yeah. So okay.
So never afraid to do that. But I think it's interesting, regardless of the sport, you there is a certain identity that comes with a coach and the ability to adapt and you know, kind of shape and into what your personnel dictates is obviously important. But then there are certain things that I've always just felt like as a coach have to be non-negotiables. I think that's why USC football is terrible on defense. They're terrible on defense because Lincoln Riley doesn't care about defense, right? Like if your head coach just doesn't give a damn about defense, yep. Like it's all about putting points on the board and yep. Your offense looks phenomenal, but you're going to get beat. You're going to get yep. beat in those games because you don't play a lick of defense. So watching, you know, watching the USC offense put up all these points while also giving up all of these points is it's on one hand you appreciate the offensive innovation, but on the other hand you go, if you care just a little bit more about that other side, things can be completely different. I don't know how much you follow college football in the Northeast, but Fordham University has one of the best offenses in all of the FCS. They're putting up, you know, close to 50 points a game, but they're giving up close to 50 points a game. So every game is a shootout, by the way. If you want a cheat code, take the over in a Fordham football game. If it's on the line, that's usually a good way to go if you want to, you know, get a quick win.
Yeah. I lean toward a balanced kind of approach, regardless of if I, you know, in basketball, I think I do. And in football, I would, you know, back in the day when I was an assistant coach for a few years, offensive coordinator at one point in my life too, which was some of the most fun I've ever had, honestly. But I think within that balance, like year to year, or maybe even within the same year sometimes, but, you know, some teams are going to have a little more offensive juice. And so we're going to get a little more out of that and lean on our defense, maybe a little less because you can trust. And then vice versa, other teams, like, you know, you're going to have to get more out of your defense because the offense isn't necessarily going to get you everything you might need. So, but for me, you know, valuing both ends, I would. And if I was a football coach, for me, I would hopefully be doing something similar to that. But knowing that, I think you're back to your identity point, right? That's a huge thing in sports. So your team's going to take on a certain identity at some point. In basketball, Bob Hurley, legendary St. Anthony's coach, and I've used this with my teams quite often, always talked about needing, you know, six to as many as 10 games to build an identity. So, you know, early in seasons, I'll talk to them.
So you think it's games that build the identity?
No. I think it's, because we talk big about being a practice team. That's a Jeff Van Gundy line. But I think the lessons, right, are in practice, you know, and the exams are on game nights. So there's value, obviously, in both those places as it relates to the development of identity.
Yeah, because I'm big on, and I think it's just because of my personality, I've always liked practice.
Yeah.
I've always liked practice. Practice is where you get to legitimately talk some noise and rub it in the face of the opponent, because you're not worried about penalties. You're not worried. Like, you get to let, if I destroy you in practice, you have to hear about it all day. You know, you can't get on a bus and go home and now I've got to, you know, just live with it. You have, and so there's a level of, I can't let him get the best of me. That you get every single day, at least that I get every single day at practice. And so I think that transition is itself to my coaching, where I'm like, you don't want to lose this practice. You don't want to lose this practice. You don't want to give it away. Because if I will metaphorically punch my teammate in the face, then what do you think I'll do to some dude that I don't know?
Yeah, it's kind of the Kobe Bryant, Paul Gasol referenced in again back to the Redeem team when Kobe sends the direct message by running through Gasol's chest. But I agree with you. In fact, again back to your initial like question of I guess philosophy, and that's another thing I say all the time. But you know, from the first day and then periodically thereafter. Hey, players make other players better. Like, we want our players making each other better. I believe that is a big part of the process at every level. So, you know, that the only, if you're challenging, you know, your teammates and they're challenging you in, you know, all healthy respects, but I mean, just getting after it, obviously, then that's a way that we all get better, you know, and in theory, that's why you play a tough schedule too, because right, the warrior philosophy that it's only through playing tough competition, engaging in competition, that you find out about yourself. So, I mean, I believe that also. So
I think for me, the philosophy has always been, if you don't lead, if you, and this is football, basketball, this is whatever I've ever done as a player or as a coach.
Yep.
Two things I want someone to say when they watch me play or when they watch a team that I coach play. Man, those guys are tough.
Yep.
Man, those guys are tough, and dang, those guys are smart. Like, to me, intelligence...
Yep.
Far in the game that it's, you know, it almost can negate some of the things that you don't have.
Effort. I was just telling our guys the other day that look at effort is going to outshine execution all day long, every day, particularly in the early season too. So, you know, if I have to choose one, you know, great effort or great execution, I'm choosing great effort all day long, and then we'll, you know, figure it out. We'll figure out the rest. This will be a commercial break brought to you by CycleBar. CycleBar. If you haven't been to CycleBar, then you haven't been on a good cycle. CycleBar, proud sponsors of the Zebra Stripes podcast.
And
hey,
I'm back.
And we're back.
I know what happened. This computer automatically connects to an older Wi-Fi network. And so I had to
that gave me time to, you know, introduce for the first time this year our proud sponsors, CycleBar.
So. Yes, our proud, not sponsors, but we would love for them to be sponsors at CycleBar. We're still angling for that CycleBar to be built in North Bridgeton, Maine, or in Bridgeton, Maine. If it's just Bridgeton, it's okay as well.
Yeah,
we'll take it right next to the golf course. Just put one right next to the golf course.
That'd be good. Yes.
Yes. So you've been hinting at the Redeem team. I want to go in. You had a chance to see it.
Yeah.
Tell me what your first thoughts were.
Well, I mean, just enjoyed the heck out of it. Actually watched it with my lovely wife, Mary Beth, MB. I thought it was just great footage of the, you know, the build up to the 08 Olympics with enough context for what had kind of come before, both the 92 Dream Team, but then the, you know, kind of getting fat and happy Americans between 92 and all the problems they had, you know, through 06. The rest of the world not only catching up, but then getting ahead. I mean, I'm going to stroke a couple of my international friends, but when I was pretty young, 30-ish, a little younger than that maybe, had some Belgian coaches who were very, you know, national level and were very familiar with Messina, who Italian coach who went on and coached with Popovich and all that. And they, you know, I had never heard his name before, but all over Europe. And these guys would come to the state to study. So I was at this little camp, you know, with Bert Hamill. And I came back to some people, I mean, not just at that camp, but later, and said, hey, look, you know, these Europeans know what the hell they're talking about. I mean, just from, you know, and we go out and have a couple of drinks at the bar and this, that, and the other thing, and talk, and I say, oh boy. And it was still, because I remember the reaction I would get from different coaches, and there was that ugly American thing. So I think on the highest levels, it took, you know, obviously the formation of the Dream Team, but then a whole nother cycle of disappointment and disbelief to fuel, you know, the resurgence of the Americans at the top of the heap, at least, you know, for now. But obviously the understanding that it's a global game and you don't own it and all of that. So I loved it. I loved the inside look at it. And that's my, you know, and I'll tell you what, and I was thinking throughout, which I'm not ready to answer just yet, but you said, you know, that would be an interesting game, the Dream Team versus the Redeem Team. And I think you're right about that, but I haven't picked a side yet.
Yeah, I loved it. Not just because of the Kobe Bryant stuff and right. Everything, which I thought was fantastically done. They didn't beat us over the head with Kobe Bryant, as you know,
yeah.
A lot of things may have because of his untimely passing. What I thought was interesting, and I want your opinion on it, because this could be the ugly American in me. We didn't really send over there the best team when we lost. We sent over there essentially a C team, right? And what we ended up finding out was, okay, when we don't send our best, we can get beat. Because, and that's the part that I don't, clearly they didn't want to, obviously, but they made a slight mention about all of the players that opted out.
Yeah.
Guys that were in their prime that opted out at that time because of the things that were going on in Russia. And, you know, people feeling apprehensive about going overseas. There were a ton of players who were scheduled to go and, you know, represent the country, the best of the best as it had been, and then they didn't go. And I think the part that they did play up, but they didn't really want to say it, was the fact that Larry Brown's ego got in the way of them just allowing these young dudes who are really good at basketball to go out there and play basketball. And you got to earn it, and all this other stuff that he was doing, kind of, you know, little brothering them. You can tell by their demeanor they weren't happy. They didn't feel accepted. Like, those two things, if those two things don't happen, if the original guys who were supposed to go, the Kevin Garnetts and the Paul Pierces and Ray Allen in his prime and all of those guys, if they go, and if Larry Brown isn't being Larry Brown, are we ever talking about the need for a redeem team?
Well, I think those are big ifs, and that was part of the chemistry. And I think, you know, I'm not certain of all of this, but my sense is that post 92, they, you know, okay, we've done what we kind of set out to do. So the egos of everybody involved, including the U.S. Olympic Committee, right? Because Colangelo had to, right? I mean, just reshape that whole thing anyway. And then the ego of the players involved, I don't think they all had any great use for us. And I've told you on this pod before, I mean, the Olympics don't do for me what they did when, you know, I was under the illusion that amateurs were competing. So, I mean, it's taken a long time for me to kind of accept the idea, regardless of what the rest of the world is doing, you know, the models of sport the rest of the world uses versus the U.S. But, you know, I just don't think we really gave a hoot and still thought we could, you know, win, which you can't. And so I tend to think, even if some of the people you're mentioning had gone over, we weren't invested, right? We weren't training for it very long, and probably would have got beat the same way that, you know, in the NBA today, you know, talented teams get beat when they don't play together. So I think and because, again, if you go back, right, we were winning, we were beating the rest of the world with true college players. That can't be, you know, call them semi-professional if you want to be a cynic, but we were beating the world. So there came a point when that was clearly not enough. So,
well, yeah, but even then, right, the landscape changed. So, you know, we're beating teams with college players. I can't say for certain if you put together a college team in 92 of Christian Laettner and Shaquille O'Neal and Chris Webber and, you know, like, there were some really talented college players out there. Grant Hill, who were available in the college pool. I think there's a chance that team still wins.
I would just say, and maybe like, I just think the mental space wasn't right. Like, I don't think it does. I hear you. I don't think it does. I don't think the mental space for those guys and for the leadership group, I don't think the mental space would have allowed for it, because it was either going to be, you know, beneath them or only half-hearted or this and that. And so to me, that's part of the thing, like what it took. And obviously Coach K, that was one of the best parts of the documentary. Now it builds up Coach K and all of that, but what you're playing for. The guys seem to get it. I don't, again, maybe that was too corny with all the military references and his background and all of that. I'm not, but he did get a group of guys that said, hey, okay, we ain't losing.
Yeah.
And resolve.
For the record, I thought all that was super corny.
Like
really corny, not even remotely interesting to me. because I just felt like it was overplayed. Well, he's a military guy and he has this.
Right.
Nobody wants to. I don't know anyone who wants to go off, represent their country, and do poorly.
Yeah. Well, I would just say that.
Think they wanted to do poorly when they lost?
I don't think it's just like you tell your teams, you know, there's a difference between want to and willing to or preparing to. So I think want and willing are different.
That's fair. I got my coaching's bag in this because I was enamored by the fact that the United States, even though it was in the world game, is not American basketball. And the fact that the world game is not American basketball is kind of interesting to me, right? Like, we're gonna create your game, but we're gonna change these rules up. And the Americans just thought they never had to adapt to those rules.
Right.
And so I thought the interesting part was watching them adapt. And by the time they thought they adapted to what they were seeing, the game had already changed again. So they had to change again. Yep. You know, like to me, I found that very interesting. Hey, we're out here playing pick and roll. You know what I'm saying? Or we're out here playing this, dump it down, and they're playing pick and roll. Okay, now we're playing pick and roll, and now they're on to, you know, like the fact that the world was a step ahead.
Yep.
Of the United States in the schematics of the international game, I thought was extremely interesting.
Yeah, and I agree. Both interesting and instructive, by the way. So, like, right? So anyone that's a lifelong learner says, okay, now, like, if you want to be whatever, remotely decent or good or great at anything you're doing, man, you better stay on it some, because that was a powerful reminder.
Got to continue to learn.
Yeah.
like those coaches clinics are not just for meeting up with the buddies and having beers. You better be in there, you know, with a pen and a pad or an iPad or however you get it down and learning some new stuff.
And then the other, you know, this again is low level interest, but most people already knew it anyway, you know. If you thought Coach K was a choir boy, you know, and hadn't read, you know, or stuff to the contrary, then you know, coming out of that documentary, oh my goodness, what, you know, the squeaky clean Duke guy actually is a, you know, the son of Polish immigrants from Chicago who, you know, tough as nails guy who's going to get in the gutter with anyone.
Yeah.
That, you know,
and cuss you out in a heartbeat.
Yep.
You can only imagine what those Duke practices are like.
Correct.
And you'll never know, because the brotherhood is the brotherhood. But I think it was good to get a little bit of that's the part that I did enjoy. Get a little the shine off of it. Like, it when you're too shiny, it's almost fake, right?
Yeah.
It's almost fake when you're too shiny. That's kind of my issue with the military dress. You know what I'm saying? When they get our kids come for JROTC and they're all dressed in their, you know, their uniforms and the buckle is super shiny and it's like, yeah, but that's not real life. That's not every day. Like,
no, and when the shield
is not shiny.
And when the Seals and the Rangers go to work, that's not what they're wearing either.
It's not what they're wearing.
So, you know, it's pageantry versus work boots.
Yep, yep. It's just interesting to see. I know we're probably heavy basketball today because of so much that's going on. But I wanted to come back to something. You were talking about it before. Upsets, so many upsets in college football last week. And it's interesting, there were so many upsets right before the initial college football playoff, you know, top four comes out, which was actually came out while we're talking. We can you know, tell the people who don't actually pay attention to that stuff what it is. But the first four or the first four college football playoffs, first four, is Tennessee, Ohio State, Georgia, and Clemson. Color me crazy, but there is no way in hell I think Clemson is anywhere near close to Alabama, which makes me know they're trying to position this so that the SEC cannot get three teams in. But there's a scenario that happens where three teams from the SEC 100% deserve to go to the college football playoffs. I don't particularly like it, but it's just the truth. If Tennessee beats Georgia, right? If Tennessee beats Georgia, then you have Tennessee going to represent the SEC East in the SEC championship against most likely Alabama. So now you're going to have an undefeated Tennessee, a one-loss Alabama in the SEC championship. Meanwhile, Georgia is going to finish out the season undefeated. I mean, without losing. So they'll only have one loss. There's no way you can keep that one-loss Georgia team out if their only loss is to a team that is ranked in the top two. And there's no way you can keep Alabama out, because if Alabama plays Tennessee again in the SEC championship and they beat Tennessee, then they'll have that almost automatic qualifier. But Tennessee will now be sitting there with one loss, having beat Alabama and beat Georgia. So you'll have three SEC teams with only one loss that have all lost to each other. How do you keep any of those three out? And then Ohio State, as long as they beat Michigan, and Michigan if they beat Ohio State.
Well, the answer is only stubborn traditionalist football people could keep that, though, you know, could keep them out, because common sense just says when you analyze the geometry of your last statement, expand the tournament, would you please? Like, holy smokes. Right. So right. I just bring it back and make it that simple, because not only were there are you proving that there could be serious errors made in just the top four, but the nature of these upsets, I think we're going to see another round of them before we're done within the top 15, suggests to me that, of course, like football teaches us, on any given Saturday or Sunday, things happen. So that's why you expand the goddamn tournament, please. And
yeah,
and just keep us, please stop this media, you know, stop making us have these arguments about the four. And whether the fifth, so that's the whole conversation. Oh, the fifth or the sixth, and you debate that. When you just let them prove it on the field, please, like we do in 1AA football, for God's sake, your own NCAA subdivision football. The only place you don't do it is at the top of the heap. Now that is stupid.
It's absolutely
plain and simple.
It's absolutely stupid. And all of the reasoning that they used to use had to do with academics while the lower levels were doing it. 1AA, D2, D3, yeah. NAIA, junior college, yeah. They were all doing it. And the argument was, well, they've missed so much school. These are student athletes. Well, we know that's not the truth now. We know you don't care about academics.
I don't. You know, I'm not going to go that far. I'll just say, look,
you think the NCAA cares about academics?
Yeah, I do. I don't think they're all people that don't care, but you have competing priorities. I think that other things are going to outweigh academic concerns, or the people that have, right, the educators at the, you know, head and core at different levels, whether they're presidents or ADs and others that have genuine interest in, you know, the concept of student athlete and college athletic education. Yeah, I think they care, but they also understand there are trade-offs. There are serious trade-offs too, by the way.
Yeah, so, but the trade-off is always less academic.
Yeah, most of the time.
The trade-off is never, hey, we're going to leave this money on the table. So, right. Like, you can't – and here's the thing.
But they don't have to be mutually exclusive, right? Because you could – right, and you know it anyway. I'm not trying to preach.
Yeah, not trying to preach.
You know the guys on all those teams that are, you know, graduating in 3 years or going on being doctors. So there's so many, you know, that it's just not fair to.
You know what? So let me clarify, because I mean what I say, but I want to clarify it.
Right.
I'm not saying that the people involved in the NCAA, don't care about academics. Right. I'm saying the NCAA as a governing body,
right?
That academics is not first. And that's what they used to sell us on.
Right.
They used to sell us that this is academic. This is student athlete.
Right.
And what we found is that's not really the case.
And that was good sales. And that was good sales, which the Taylor Branch documentary on it all. So, you know, the student, you know, not Avery Brundage, because he was the IOC head, but the head of the NCAA, name escaped me right now.
Mark Emmert. You know,
not well, long before that, the original.
Oh, okay. See, yeah.
Name escaping me, but I know it. And right, student athlete was one among the greatest brands ever created.
Absolutely.
So they went to a great end. So you're right.
Yeah, I think I just think it went out the window when I all of a sudden looked up and these teams were playing 13 and 14 game schedules. And they were ending the season, you know, at 12-2 or 13-1. And I'm like, wait a minute. So all that would need to happen would be for them to not schedule 13 games and go back to scheduling 10 and 11. And then you have your rounds of the playoffs and you're not missing anything. Well, that makes sense to me. I'm with you. I think it's a complete and utter, it's ridiculousness that we don't have at the least 16 teams in this thing.
Yeah. Like, yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's a fair jump.
Because 8, to me, you're just going to have the same questions.
Yep.
Speaking of which, you were serious when you said, there were some upsets, you know, last week. And I was like, really? There were upsets? Because I was thinking about the highest level. But then when we started going down the list, and shout out to you for, you know, picking up on this and talking about this with the boo thing. You know, yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, they survived. They're good. 5 and 6 were off. So they didn't have to worry about it. But 7, 8, you get to 9. Oklahoma State gets stroked by Kansas State. Yep. Kansas State is the team that nobody wants to play when you're good. When you're good, Kansas State is not that team. Wake Forest, the number 10, gets waxed by unranked Louisville. At least Kansas State was ranked 22nd. Louisville is not even ranked. They were 4-3 on the season. They were 2-3 in the ACC, and they waxed on Wake Forest. USC survived against Arizona, who is terrible. UCLA did well against Stanford, but Stanford is down. Ole Miss survives against Texas A&M. Syracuse, the 16th seed, who was 6-1 and 4-1 in the ACC, who barely lost to Clemson, gets waxed by almost 20 by Notre Dame, 41-24. Cincinnati, the 20th seed, the 20th ranked team, gets waxed by an unranked UCF team. Missouri pounds South Carolina, 23-10. South Carolina, the 25th ranked team. So a lot of the teams, a lot of shuffles going on at that top level. So imagine, right, if you were only taking the top eight, right? If you were only
That's exactly my point. That's when I looked at it. That's when it struck me. And I said, okay, if there are chinks that are running this deep into the in the armor at the top, then, you know, you can this and that. And I'll give you one other thought on it too. But I'm glad I brought something to this party, by the way. I'm glad I brought
some.
I brought some football to the party this week. My other theory on it, though, besides the fact that, you know, we know, you know, parity kind of reigns supreme everywhere these days. But my other big theory that people were talking about before this year started, did the NIL play any role in the dramatic outcomes of some of these games, which is to say, on some of these real good teams, you have guys that are for the first time outright getting paid. And you had some guys getting paid that on the surface anyway, because I didn't watch any of these games. I just saw the scores. They didn't deliver. They said, well, I'm good. You know, people have wondered about that.
So I you stumbled on
that's the pro. Okay, go ahead.
You stumbled on something. I don't want to go heavily into it because I think this is almost an entire episode that we could do on it.
Okay.
I talked to you about it before.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the NIL.
Right.
It is the extra year that the NCAA gave the entire world.
So you think this is all old, mature guys beating up on young pups?
Exactly. Look at the teams who Kansas State notoriously has an older team. Right. Like, that's usually the model that they – if you look at it, right, Louisville has a quarterback who's been there 5 years. Hendon Hooker's 23 years old, almost 24, I think. Stetson Bennett is 25 years old, still playing college football, right? So if you look at it, the top teams, those top-level teams, they can kind of sort of weather the storm because they have such elite talent. But then when you start getting to the 6 through 12, those teams, if they lost guys to the NFL, which a lot of those teams do, and the unranked team had a bunch of their seniors come back because they could now, they could have this extra year, it just makes a big difference. That's why you've seen so many upsets of FCS teams beating FBS teams because they're all super old. They're bringing all their guys back. That's also why we've seen the service academies all struggle because what's the one school that can't allow kids to stay for an extra year? Navy, Army, Air Force. So now the advantage that they had or them leveling the playing field isn't there. So Army is bringing in their new freshmen and sophomores that are now elevated. But they lost their senior class. Meanwhile, Houston got to bring back almost all of their dudes who were seniors for an extra year. And it's going to be that – you're going to see it in basketball. Mark my words. I am going through rosters right now, and I am finding the oldest teams. Remember Baylor when Baylor made that run? That was a team full of older dudes. And you and I said on the podcast, hey, that's a bunch of grown men playing against a bunch of kids.
Well, I get it, but I like my story better. So We're gonna have to research that one. And definitely old college basketball.
Drew Timmy's back. Drew Timmy's back for another season.
Love it.
He's 175 years old out here playing. He is super old, and he is going to murder these kids out here this year. If you don't have Drew Timmy as your preseason like player of the year, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, well, I'm happy. Like, I never met him. I don't know much about him other than what we see. But good for him for being back there. I mean, obviously it's in his interest and all that. But
he better walk out of there with a specialist degree.
Yeah, but just ride that for all it's worth, and you know that's great. I mean,
I'm not mad at him.
I know that. I know that. Oh, yeah. A lot of guys, less and less, obviously, even if you got the notoriety he's got throughout his career, less and less guys would stay, even if they weren't elite picks. And just so for him to ride the experience of major college basketball for everything it's worth and
there you know, guys leave the rest. I'm telling you, I'm watching the transfer portals. I'm watching the guys who transferred, who finished up their career at one place. And what we've seen, be it like the grad transfer, is now the super grad transfer. Some of these guys, I mean, North Carolina's going to benefit from it. They've got a couple guys who are back who would have normally have left, who couldn't leave because it was so crowded that they were almost forced to stay another season because there was nowhere for them in the draft. So they're like, well, let me go back and run it back one more time. That's how these teams end up looking like Baylor did 2 years ago. And I would not be surprised if the team that cuts down the nets this year is the team that has a bunch of 22 and 23 and 24-year-olds on it.
Or it's Hubert's team. But
they're gonna have a good amount of grown-ups on there.
I was just throwing it out there, of course.
No,
Hey,
I'm gonna be so happy if he actually gets it done. That'd be great.
Yeah. Hey, what do you have any thoughts on the Patriots win over the Jets? Since Zappy was our, theme last week.
Yeah, I don't, because I think the Jets are like horrible. I think that's a bad. I mean, it's a win, so you take the win where you take the win, right? Yeah. But I want to see him do it against the team that we go.
You want to see who do it?
That's formidable.
Who do you want to see do it?
I want to see any quarterback do it, whether it's Zappy or whether it's.
Well, this was Mac Jones. I mean, played the whole game, but
no, I know. Yeah. But I'm saying either quarterback. Yeah. I don't care who it is, because I told you already. I think they're the same guy. I think they're kind of. Yeah. Is 6-1 hand, although Zappy seems to have that sauce that Matt Jones doesn't have, like that something that you can't really put your finger on. I just need to see these guys play against actual legitimate like teams to say, okay, because every time I see Matt Jones play against really good teams, he doesn't look the greatest.
Yeah, well, I go further. I go to the Belichick angle of it, right? So, I mean, they were playing the 5-2 Jets, who were, looking to kind of ride this, role they're on, I guess. And the Patriots, obviously, completely the other. So I look at it and as another example where, first of all, Belichick's defense shows up like it didn't against the Bears. Mm-hmm. It is the strength of the team. And I think as Fields, Justin Fields, right, showed, like it's probably right now only good if the other team's got like an extremely average quarterback. So Bill Belichick against average quarterbacks, unleashes a defense, and now the Patriots the Patriots have a fighter's chance, because if the refs don't make a horrible call on roughing the passer on a pick six by the Jets, it's 17-3. I don't think the rest of the game unfolds that way, but That keeps the game close. The Patriots get the lead. Belichick's defense gets to control Zach Wilson. The Patriots win. And the problem is when they play a mobile quarterback, a better team, or maybe the other team even has a better defense than the Jets, then, you know, obviously, again, the Patriots, to no one's surprise, just an okay team. So I thought it was a good win by the Patriots, and so some people in New England just poo-poo the win. No, I think it was a really good win, an important one too, a must win. It was a must win for them. But a done against a Jets team with a quarterback who's extremely unproven himself to this point. So that's where I think Mac Jones has to prove himself, or Bailey Zappi for that matter, but Jones has to prove himself against better teams. I'm telling you, the Pats defense and their team in general has to prove it competes against better teams. Or it'll just be the outcome of Buffalo, you know, in last year's playoff. They'll just get run off the field. So,
but I think it's been well documented that Belichick struggles versus athletic quarterbacks.
Okay.
Like for years. Like that's been his kryptonite for God knows how long, you know. But I remember there was some strange stat that one year when I think the Patriots won the Super Bowl that year, but their defense was like lights out except for against all of the athletic quarterbacks.
Right.
Like Lamar Jackson cut him up, Deshaun Watson cut him up, you know, like all of the dudes who just have that ability to murder you with the legs just did the damn thing. And they were like, oh, that's an interesting fact. It's an interesting tidbit, but I'm with you. But we have to apologize. We got to apologize to the people because we said take the under in that Bears Patriots game. And what we really should have said was take the Bears, yeah, take the points. Cause we kind of had a feeling this just didn't smell right.
Yeah, if you go back and listen, we were definitely on it that it didn't smell right. And as we were kind of wrapping up our conversation, we rather quickly, because it wasn't that important to us, said, yeah, take the under. But we misspoke, and what we meant to say was take the Bears all day long.
And they went over, but they went over like 9 times out of 10. They probably wouldn't have gone over, but they did go over. They got the touchdown in the fourth quarter after it was kind of already out of reach for what we saw the Patriots doing, and that's where we were. The interesting thing, because I know we're coming, but I don't want to leave without getting to this. The Nets, as they say, mutually agreed to part ways with Steve Nash. It's a move that I thought should have probably been done in the offseason, because Steve Nash is not a head basketball coach. He was in over his head. I thought so. I don't have anything against, well, I do have stuff against Steve Nash, but it's just fan stuff. Like, I'm mad that he goes down in history as a back-to-back MVP when Kobe and Shaq are out there rolling around with one. That really irks me. But I just thought he was – you can't have a coach who doesn't know how to, you know, do the job of managing people. And he didn't seem to have the ability to manage people, which is weird because he was a point guard. And a lot of what you're doing as a point guard is managing people.
Yeah, but Phil Jackson took over for Paul Westhead. Am I missing someone there? God, that doesn't seem right.
Westhead?
No, Westhead. I'm thinking of the Lakers when Westhead left. And obviously, Phil Jackson replaced Doug Collins in Chicago. But my point is, Magic got Westhead fired. Magic Riley. Hall of Famers. So anyway, the players and the star players wouldn't play for Westhead, but they wanted Riley, and they wouldn't play for Doug Collins, and Phil Jackson was more there. So my point is that clearly, maybe the lack of experience, factor. I don't think that plays as great a role as does, you know what, the players just did. No, they were now maybe when exactly that surfaced, how much of it was his inexperience that they just sniffed out, or whether they, no, if players said we're not playing for this guy, and they definitely weren't playing for him. And
I just think that they at some point they looked up, and people have to get over this, by the way. Well, this is the guy that you wanted. Yeah, I can see a woman and think she's gorgeous, and I want that woman. But when I start to talk to her and spend time with her, all of a sudden realize this isn't the woman for me. Like, it's okay to just be wrong. Like, they make it seem as if, well, you guys, no, like, our issues are not effort issues. Our issues are not knowing how to put together game plans that fit more than just two people into, you know, a game plan. It's figuring out rotations and how to get other people in the best position to be successful as the role players. And you just don't see it. It's if KD and Kyrie are off, they're not winning that game. Like, if KD's off, they're not winning that game. If Kyrie is non-existent,
they're not gonna with the same roster, they're not gonna win if they're off with any coach either. So the question is whether the whole thing gets engaged more effectively, you know.
I think they have some guys who can do some things.
Yeah, maybe.
I just don't know if they've been ever put in position to do them.
Yeah, I don't know either. But every time we get into these discussions, because, you know, it would happen from time to time with Coach Friend, and you know, I end up, you know, people getting accused of, well, you're just another coach protecting a coach. So I have friends where conversations come. I say, you know what? Yeah, maybe to some degree, because, right, I understand that it's hard, and you do too.
Yeah.
So it's just like without real inside information, without being there, you're just guessing. Is the issue the lack of experience and inability to put the game plan and whatnot, or is the issue that couldn't create the buy-in in the locker room, beginning with your lead players? Because we all know you need your best players on board and everyone else follows. You know, that's where I still think they got a problem, right? Because if Kyrie's the alpha, now he's going to get, you know, now this is good. I mean, this is good because now, okay, Kyrie, now we don't have this inexperienced coach that, you know, you could hang some of this difficulty on, right? So now it's, you know, Udoka, you know, Ime leaves Boston, goes back with his guys, you know, proved last year that he could take a team to the championship level. You guys supposedly have that. So, I mean, we'll
I'll say this. If the Udoka thing happens,
yeah,
it's a win for the Nets.
Yeah, I agree with that.
If you go from Steve Nash to Udoka,
right,
and it's not just, hey, Udoka did this last year.
Right.
Udoka's
right.
been on the bench coaching right. for years.
Agreed.
So he comes in with immediate, like, okay. It just only helps that he did what he did last year with Boston.
Yep.
But it's interesting, right? Because if Udoka is able to go be a head coach at another NBA team, what did he actually do that is so bad?
Well, we're going to find out, because he's not going to get that job without that.
Someone's going to have to disclose something. Like,
correct.
That's what I'm struggling to understand. A, if you did something so bad that you get suspended for a year, why did we not just fire you?
Yeah.
Okay, we're just being petty. That's why we don't want to fire you. I get down with that.
Yeah.
So now you just allow him, you're just going to allow him to go and coach essentially a team that you're going to be rivaling against?
Yeah.
Listen, I don't want to wade into waters that are too murky for me to see in. I know you don't as well, but it don't look good. Especially if he gets to the Nets and he starts cooking. If he gets to the Nets and he starts cooking, and it's super early in the year. So all of this, the Nets are only 2-whatever. Who gives a damn? Like if he gets to New Jersey, or excuse me, Brooklyn, and he starts cooking and he gets that thing working immediately or gets it right immediately, and they're coming, and now you're looking at a Nets Celtics playoff series. The Celtics have to pray they win that series. They have to absolutely pray they win that series. You cannot rest on the, or you cannot fall back on the, well, at least we did the right thing.
Yep.
What's the right thing? You got to come out and tell us what the right thing is now.
Yeah, because if you did the right thing, then the Nets did the wrong thing. And the public, the world right now isn't gonna necessarily, I don't think necessarily allow the wrong thing to happen here. So there's a rub. I don't know where the rub is.
I don't either, but I'm not really into drama, but I'm into like interaction and how this plays out.
Right.
Because someone's gonna have to explain why a guy like Matt Barnes, who's always been willing to just say what's on his mind, came out in support of Udoka, and then less than 24 hours later recanted what he said and said, no, this is awful. Like, I can't stand behind him on that. So it's that bad that this guy, who has no attachment to the NBA now, really, other than being a former player, was willing to come back out and go, nah, sorry, wash my hands.
Here's what else we'll know. If he doesn't get the Nets job, then we'll know that it, in fact, is that serious.
It is that serious.
He is the obvious candidate since he had been there and has all this experience. So,
you're right.
One way or another, more information's coming either way.
Big facts. Well, I know we're getting down to the nitty-gritty. We're getting ready for the season to get started with basketball. That is at the high school level, at the prep level, at the college level. We're getting ready for
November 7th. November 7th, next for college, next Monday.
Yes, I am locked and loaded, ready to go. And I am going to be sharing my adventures in college and college basketball betting. I am doing a basketball challenge. I'll tell you guys more about it next week. But I'm really excited about it. I'm really excited to see what it does. They say that you can talk about anything that you do, but it's only if you have a legitimate record of it that it matters. And so I am going to wade into the world and put a legitimate record out there and see what it comes out to. So I'm looking forward to it. I know you're looking forward to the basketball season starting for your guys and you know, everything you've got going this year. And I'm sure we'll hear about that as well.
You will.
Yes, I'm sure I will. Ladies and gentlemen, that is another episode of Zero Strikes Podcast. I'm Coach Gene Clemens, joined as always by Coach Witt, with LeJure, the head basketball coach at Bridgeton Academy up there in Bridgeton, Maine, North Bridgeton, Maine. If you got kids, by the way, and they're really good basketball players, you should have Witt coach them. And I'm not just saying that because I love the guy. I'm saying that because he's a damn good coach. So until next time, make sure you do all of the good stuff. Like, subscribe, You know, catch us on all of the platforms. Every week we're on a new platform. So wherever you get your podcast, you can find Zebra Stripes Podcast there. And we will talk to you next week.